Very proud of what we did in the independent movement. One is, with the Shackman case, we ended patronage. It was interesting because later when I went to the state's attorney's office, I was on all three sides of that case, for and against. And Michael Shackman was my successor in IDI, was the party who brought the suit. I talked to them and gave them some little advice, but I don't take much credit for it. It was part of what the independent movement did. And it functionally ended patronage. So at the end of vote fraud and the end of patronage, the whole political system changed in Chicago.
And how did you come to know Shackman?
Through the Independent Voters of Illinois. Okay. Yeah.
And did you know him long before he started the
legislation? Yeah, Michael was my successor as state chair. I probably knew him a good 6, 8, 10 years.
Okay. And did you ever work on anything with him that may have foreshadowed the legislation in ending the patronage and vote?
It wasn't legislation, it's court. It was ultimately the Supreme Court. The original case came about here in the local court, but ultimately went up under Burns versus Elrod. Elrod was the sheriff. And interestingly enough, I was in the state's attorney's office. So effectively was Elrod's attorney when they went up to challenge it. And the Supreme Court ended up saying that it was unconstitutional, patronage was.
And how did people respond? Was there any hard feelings about that?
Most people who were working like court clerks or something were delighted they didn't have to work precincts, okay. It didn't change the world, the organization still had its strength, but it changed the nature. There are people who believe, going back to Andrew Jackson with the victim, with the victory goes the spoils, and it's called the spoils system. And that basically ended. And it was time for it to end. All things have a time to end.
Okay. You had mentioned the ethnic groups like the blacks and Hispanics on the west side and their experiences with the voting. And I remember reading that they had benefited from the Democratic machine at one point or another, but kind of outgrew the machine, as you mentioned before, that they were kind of their own.
That's a little simplistic, if I may. In 1928 or so, both Jews and blacks were basically Republican voters. The Republicans and the blacks came about as a result really of the Civil War. And I suppose some of the aspects of the biggest races being the Southern Democrats. And what happened was patronage was a source for poor people. If you look among the older clerks, they're all poor people who went for jobs. And the genius of Dawson, the congressman, who was regarded as the head of the black communities, he didn't look for any big jobs for his people like judges. He traded them for lots of small jobs for the working class people. So it was an escape for people. And if people are poor, they look for any escape. And I think what happens in America is that if people start going to school and they get educated, people move up. There's the old story of the black woman who frequently works in people's homes and decides that her children never will. And I mean, it's a normal movement. The only difference with blacks is they didn't immigrate. They came as slaves. So it was a different time structure. But there was a time and the place where most precinct captains in black areas were whites. That changed. So everything had some gradual growth to it. And it did gradually grow. You can't do a reform from the outside if there's no desire from the inside. And there's a different relationship. Blacks who are in the machine are partners now. John Stroger, who I know fairly well, is head of the county board, okay? And people did come up and move and take more part, but that's the process of America. You become more integrated, you become more growth to things, your goals get to be, when you become middle class, there's not a lot that the machine can do for you. If you haven't got what to eat, they're the most important thing in the world.
Okay. Okay. And do you remember around what time this change started occurring, where the precinct captains started becoming black or whatever the ethnic majority was in that neighborhood?
After the end of the Second War, because people who came back weren't going to put up with the way the world was before. So the generation coming back created the independence. And I think as you started getting into the 60s and 70s, it kept growing.
I see. Now, these ideas that you espoused at this time, being in the IVI, you had mentioned that when you were at Chicago, it was a little problematic because you had your own ideas. Were these some of the ideas that you had while you were at Chicago?
As you grow, it's really hard to say. You grow when you think and you interact with people and you develop. I do think to some degree, I've always been involved in intellectual communities, and you have a certain type of group. These I refer to as the people of the book because they're always reading. Okay? They're tremendous readers. So most of my ideas, I would say the only thing was I was slightly less left than was common at the time, and I really never had a desire to deal with the radicals. I was regarded to some degree as being anti-communist because they have no tolerance of independence, which was not that popular in the 40s and 50s, right? Because they had been our allies. They're my ideas, and they're specifically mine, and they change. In IVI, I generally regarded myself as an independent Republican, which was a fairly minority there. Most independents regard themselves as independent Democrats. The whole issue changed with the collapse of the machine, because one of the reasons that we took our position was the machine ran the city like it owned it, and it did own it. And we had some very, very fine Republicans, of people like Jim Thompson, Bill Scott, Governor Ogilvie. And it's very funny when you say mayor, you always mean mayor David at first. When you say governor, you always mean Governor Ogilvie. And I don't know, there were different kinds of people. We were very close to Abner Mikva, who ran for Congress as an independent. There were a bunch of people in Springfield who were, we had tri-member districts, which we don't have anymore. So you had a lot of people like Robert Mann and Tony Siriano, who were very fine independent people. So you get all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. So did the collapse of the machine really have much of an impact? It appears that those who were in power weren't as negatively affected as one might think by its collapse.
It's kind of a change. It's like the Normans conquering England. There's a whole change to what it is. It's like Young Daly talks about the fact that he can't control the world in a much less difficult situation than his father was. It's not as polarized as it was. It's a fairly typical, you remember this, the Daly machine of the father was considered to be as one of the last strong machines in America.
Okay. What then influenced your decision to attend Chicago Kent rather than going to Chicago's law school?
I was in candidacy for my master's. That there was a, I was married on the day the Korean War started. Yeah. So all of my life has been on the edge of being drafted, and I don't know with my flat feet if they would ever take me, but everybody said, keep going to school. So I thought I would go to law school and pick Kent. I'm not sure why. and just started there and really grew up almost accidentally there. And it turned out I really fit in law and I really liked law. It was hard, I got out and I had no connections or anything, so we had space for services. I worked with a couple older lawyers doing errands for them, and they had a use of a telephone and a desk. And by little, built a practice and went in with people. It was always in small groups. And did a certain amount of practice in law. And I've been involved in a campaign with a man named Bernard Carey, who was a Republican candidate for state's attorney. A very reformed, very decent man. And when we beat Hanrahan, you know, Hanrahan, does that name mean anything to you? You never heard about Black Panthers?
Yes, I have.
Well, Hanrahan was the guy who charged into the apartment shooting, which is rather stupid for a state's attorney to do. So the issue in the campaign was Hanrahan's action. And when we won, I went to Kerry and asked to go in. It was the first job I ever really had. I became head of the civil division, dealing with all civil litigation. And it was an exciting job.
Okay, so this was after you earned your degree from Chicago County.
Yeah,
when you worked.
That.
Okay, and so what led to your decision to enter the civil division, that particular type of law?
It was an exciting job, right in the heart of everything. And it was very, very funny because there were people in county government. I remember a guy comes over and says to me, I can never work with you, you were our opponents. And then he apologized afterwards because when I was there, nothing I do was political. I told him basically, I'm a reformer. And these people were my best clients and I gave them the best treatment because they were the most important clients. So we did deal with everybody. Down the hall from me here is Dick Elrod, who's in the wheelchair. You know about that, I assume.
I don't recall.
He had been sheriff. Before he was sheriff, he was corporation counsel. There was a protest and a riot. He tackled somebody, missed, and went down a flight of stairs, crippling himself. I don't know what you remember or not, because, you know, I'm going over half a century. And you're not much more than 24 or 25.
29.
Oh, you're an old woman, okay.
Okay. And just going back for a moment, were you involved in any organizations in college? Anything like law or politics?
You know, I was involved in things, but I was never really heavily involved. I'm peripherally involved in things, or all kinds of things happening. I was a commuter. That meant I spent an hour or some minutes each way on the streetcar. And life got more difficult. And I've always been crazy. Here I was an hour and a quarter away, and I would take the 8 o'clock class in the morning. So I'd get on the streetcar with the people going to the factories. And the kids leaving on campus usually started at 10.
Okay. Were there any memorable experiences at Chicago Kent that may have influenced your decision to become a judge later in life?
I don't think so. I've always had a high standard of what I believe in and want to do. But I've never been driven toward anything. Whatever I would do, I try to work hard as. I don't think there was. I worked hard at school, took a number of difficult courses, and learned a lot. It was a hard school in the University of Chicago.
So what sorts of courses did you have? Did you have the Common Core and then you kind of went into your major?
Well, the 4 years, of the college, we had basically no electives. So we would have college, and we would have history, we would have social science, we would have literature, a variety of general education. Indeed, all the schools I've gone to I've had very few electives, and now everything is electives, okay? And I think it's wrong, because I think with a lot of electives, you get specialized things in exotic. I know people who've never had a year of American history. And American history, particularly laws based on American history and a little bit of English history. That's the tradition we grew out of. And then I went into economics, did quite a bit. I didn't like economics as much. You know what econometrics is? It's economics based upon mathematics. And I really didn't like it because I've always been more institutionally oriented. And took a number of both history and poli-sci classes, which I enjoyed.
So when you decided not to continue in economics, did any of the professors or anybody try to get you to change your mind?
I had a friend of mine who ended up, Jerry Marks from Pittsburgh, and he went into Vegas, spent his life in government service, who really did, was, I felt guilty about leaving. But that was about it. People aren't that much involved in somebody else's life. They weren't in mine.
Okay. Well, did you pass the bar exam the first time you took it?
No.
Does anyone ever pass the bar exam the first time they take it?
It's very funny, the same thing in becoming a judge. There's certain things you got to do a couple times to get there normally. Although when I went over, when you failed the bar, you talked to somebody who said I was just a little low in everything. There were no glaring problems, and I passed them the second time.
Okay, and the first firm that you became a member of, as I understand it, was Lynn, Margos, Carey.
Well, I went out first by myself. I did some work, and then there was a man named Paul Pavlon. He and I did. Come in.
One moment, please. Okay.
It's hard to, you start out, and lawyers are like pack rats. You get together a bunch and you work together. And Paul Pavlon and I, we did some work together. He died a young man of cancer. And we worked with a lawyer who was giving us a, but it really wasn't a firm. The first time was a firm was Lynn Curie, Marigus, which was also a funny firm. It was more like a bunch of people together than a law firm, but it was a law firm. And the first real firm I was when I came out as state's attorney into Frost, Schumann and Drake, which had been a firm for many years. Lawyers have millions of different sets of relationships in a firm.
Okay, and I see that the second firm was 1973 when you went there, but were you at the first firm, Lynn, Marigos, Carey, and Richter, when you took on the Carey case?
It wasn't a case, it was a campaign.
Oh, Carey campaign, excuse me, for state's attorney.
It was such a funny firm. It was like a bunch of people all together. And sometimes I wasn't sure whether it was even a firm or not. Sam Marigus was a Democratic representative who happened to be a judge later on. And he was nervous because I was opposing the mayor, so he got upset with me. So I don't know at times whether I was in the firm or not.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He worried about it, nobody else worried about it.
Okay, I was going to ask how you overcame that, but there was just one person then. Okay. And when you were there, were there any other famous clients or any other notable moments other than the Carey campaign?
There was a case we had which broke the system of elections, because the machine knocked people off. And we joined together with some others. And I have it on my recon. Trying to remember the name of the case. And it was a big case because they would count you out. Buchanan versus Holtzman. and became Telcer versus Holtzman, where if a machine opposed somebody, they would count them out, and there was no system of review. And ultimately, it developed a different system where it became review, and little by little, the corrupt system that the machine had of forcing its enemies off ended up disappearing, and I was very proud of that. And this Telcer, because that's what it was put into. And later on, when I practiced, I represented a group of people who were called denturists. They were people who made dentures. Under our law, you can't make dentures directly for people. It has to go through a dentist. This is not the case in maybe half a dozen states in all of Canada, because the denturists were people who made appliances, and the dentists never made appliances. They got a mold, and the technicians did it. The dentists weren't particularly good at it, and we worked a lot with them. And I think what happened is the methodology of dentistry changed, and people did not get their teeth extracted. It used to be, believe it or not, in places like Montreal, Quebec, for a girl's wedding present, they would extract her teeth and get a denture for her, because people would lose their teeth. That all disappeared.
Okay. And how common was it for lawyers at this time to take on the machine as you did in these cases?
In the forefront of every reform, in every society, is generally led by lawyers. Lawyers are like anybody else. Some of them just want to make money. Some want to be exciting. We had a number of lawyers. It was not uncommon. And there were a number of lawyers who tried and did things. And many of them are now gone. But most of the reforms in Chicago politically were led by lawyers.
And I guess what I'm wondering is if there was any real opposition just trying to stop lawyers such as yourself from coming against this machine and those in the reform movement. Were there any problems you faced with people just really opposing you?
The mentality of Chicago was, it is not now, talking about 10, 20, 30 years ago, that people were looking for lawyers with influence. None of the people who were reformers had any influence. Okay. I could not contemplate becoming a judge at the time Mayor Daley was there. It was incomprehensible. Oh, I should say, it's very funny, I was involved with the community organization. That's where I got involved.
Okay, and at what time was this you were involved with the community organizations?
When we moved to mid-50s, we moved to the South. In fact, the area you live in was part of it. It was a group called SECO, Southeast Community Org, made up of five subordinate groups. And I came from the one in Marionette Manor. And we did a lot of exciting things. I'm trying to see. I had a picture which I thought was really quite funny, because it showed a bunch of us meeting the mayor.
Oh.
I think he would have done. I don't think he had any love for me, but I got a kick out of the picture. And community groups were very good. They attempted to keep some stability. And I think they were very important.
Okay. So this was when you moved to the
South Side.
But previous to that, you were in Evanston.
No. I was in Oak Park.
Oh, you were in Oak Park
previous
to that.
After Evanston, when we left the South Side.
Okay, so that's after. Okay, so going back to when you were in Oak Park, how political?
I just joined the regular Democrats and did some work, not monumental. I remember I wasn't old enough to vote. Voters at 21. So I was 18, 19, 20 entry there, and we worked in a couple of campaigns.
Do you remember what sorts of campaigns?
Yeah, John Boyle was state's attorney. And he got himself in a mess. An investigator misled him, and the investigator was wrong, and he was essentially dumped, and he ran and lost. There's not a touch of futility. Okay? And there was a suburban organization, which were always looser than the city organization.
Okay. But were they sort of akin to the city organizations? Did anybody from the suburban ones and the city ones kind of work together?
They were related,
things?
Yes. Because the mayor of the city of Chicago really was head of the county. So they pretty much did work together. You had more Republicans out in the suburb. And these were suburbs were moderately heavy Republican, as opposed to now. Cook County suburbs are fairly even.
Yeah. So when you moved to the South Side and you were a member of CECO, what other sorts of neighborhood organizations existed?
There's a synagogue, there's a KAM, that's where what's Jesse Jackson's organization?
Operation Push
has the building there. And so we were involved in the synagogue. And
so you went all the way from 90th to, that's about 40-something, 50th, 49th, 50th
yeah.
Street. You went to
yeah.
Hyde Park to go to synagogue.
Yeah.
Okay. And
well, we went to the local one and then another local one, but we liked KAM better.
Okay. And I'm not quite sure, what's KAM, does it have a full name?
The full Hebrew name, which won't do both of us any good.
Okay.
It's one of the first synagogues in Chicago called the Congregation of the Men of the West. And somewhere there's a plaque, I believe, in the federal building, because it started in downtown. Probably this thing is probably 150 years old. So, and it's a reform. Jews have Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. It's a reform. And their rabbi was always very outstanding in a very liberal institution.
Okay. You mentioned to me that you weren't always very active, but you did have a bar mitzvah. Was that as a part of the Reform congregations as
no.
well?
When we were living in Lawndale, first of all, in the Russian immigrant groups, almost everybody was Orthodox. If you were an atheist, you were out of an Orthodox background. The Reform came more with the German Jews and the more Americanization. So what we did is you went to a rabbi and the rabbi would teach you your stuff and then you'd have your bar mitzvah. I did not have a lot of religious education, maybe 6 months or a year. Okay. Which is interesting because since we had our kids, I think we've probably been tied to one congregation or another for 50 years. I'm still not, as they would say, a good churchgoer.
Okay. And your time on the South Side, was this the 1960s?
I think it was the mid-50s. Okay. I should remember because we had a second child. And we were living on Jackson and Austin. And our standard joke is we left the kids out. There was only a boulevard out there. So I think it was mid-50s. Yeah. I have three children. Two were born before. Third one was born when we were on the South Side.
Okay. So at this time in the mid-50s, then, what was your political affiliation?
Well, after I left Oak Park, I came in very quickly with some friends into the IVI and became very independent. And I guess IVI is a moderately liberal organization. It's not a really left organization. People like Stas Terkel and Quentin Young never thought we were liberal enough.
Oh, so you were familiar with Studs Terkel?
Everybody's familiar with Studs Terkel.
I mean, were you more of a friend to Studs Terkel?
There's a lot of emotional left there, which I never bought, okay? They were further over than we were, and they were much more, I would regard them as much more fellow traveling. We were independent liberal, I think they were much more left.
Okay. So was he a member of the IVI as well?
No.
No.
There were a number of people who worked together on campaigns, but they were really to the left of us. I don't know how much that circle ever really worked.
Okay. In just a moment, please, Judge Gardner.
All right.